Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Back on the economy today again with Jack Rasmus. Delighted to have him back. Jack is a professor of political economy at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University. He's also a freelance journalist, a frequent speaker. He's a playwright. He's the author of The War at Home, The Bush Corporate Offensive Against American Workers and the Unions. And he's got a couple of new books in progress. One, I believe, should be out before too long. And I believe, I'll give you both titles. I'm not sure which one is coming out first. Maybe this one, called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, and The Trillion-Dollar Income Shift, the second one, Essays on Income Inequality in America. I'm confused. Well, another book is titled Capital in the 21st Century. Jack, I need you to straighten me out.
The one that's coming out from Pluto Press, Paul Gray McMillan Distributors here in a couple months, is Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. The Capital of the 21st Century is in progress and probably won't be out until late next year.
So about a year away.
And the other one is being reviewed. So the one that's imminent is Epic Recession. That's coming out very shortly. And the first book, by the way, is titled The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush.
I've been saying it wrong every program.
It's okay.
Oh, my goodness.
It's the same content, so it doesn't matter.
Same content.
Same idea. It's about the offensive against workers and labor for 30 years.
It's been a month since you were last on, and by the way I look at it, and we want your perspective, it seems like the global economic crisis rolls on, even though our Fed Chairman Bernanke says the recession is over. It may not be a robust recovery for a good while, but the recession is over. And they wouldn't lie to us, would they, Jack? But consider, I mean, there's so much going on that seems negative to me. And one of them that strike, two of them that strike me very, very briefly, we've got another wave of mortgage resets that coming, a much bigger group of mortgages, quantity of mortgages in the subprime, these so-called Alt-A mortgages that are given to people with less than stellar credit ratings. So they're risky. The rates are going to be reset up higher. That's one problem. And I sent you an email this morning very briefly saying I skimmed through a piece saying that the Labor Department is corrupting the employment data, that they basically were ordered to make it look better month after month. So they've been lowering the numbers. But this piece said something to the effect that if you look at the employment situation state by state, it is absolutely dismal in the numbers of jobs being lost and so on. So I'm really interested in your thoughts on all of that, plus whatever else is on your mind to explain the current situation.
Well, sure. Let's take the employment situation first.
I got to stop you. We got that first break coming up.
Okay.
I'll let you get your thoughts together. Let's take that break, come back, and then you jump in and explain it all.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour on with Jack Rasmus talking about the economy. Jack, let me just briefly give your website. It's www.kyklosproductions.com. And for me, a much simpler way to bring you right up very simply and easily is simply to Google Jack Rasmus website. You go right to the appropriate one. You can get on it. You can get the correct titles of all your books, Jack, and all the other stuff that you're doing. And there's plenty. So absolutely check out Jack's site. Oh, explain the situation in the economy, Jack. I'm so eager to hear what you have to say.
Okay, well, let's take your two points. One, are they tinkering, to put it mildly, with the employment data? And the answer to that is yes, very much so. And the other question is the mortgage problem, the housing problem, really resolved? Or as you say, do we have a new wave coming? And the answer to that is yes, plus a wave in commercial property foreclosures and defaults coming that's maybe as big as the subprime. So let's take both of those. Let's take the employment thing. We're probably somewhere around 20 to 25, probably close to 25 million unemployed. There's no way you can get a recovery as long as that's the case with that many unemployed, especially since today those that are even not unemployed can no longer use, no longer have access to the volume of credit to stimulate consumption. The debt situation is for the consumer and consumer balance sheet is overwhelming. Consumers are about 130% of their disposable income, their debt-to-income ratio. It's going to take years for consumers to work that down so they start spending again. And there's no real wage growth for decades, and it's going south even faster now. So there's no way you're going to get consumers to lead this recovery. And that's in addition to the fact that we've got another wave of foreclosures coming, as you say, Alt-A's. The worst for mortgages were subprimes. They've worked their way through much of that. But now Alt-A's, which weren't as bad, Alternative A mortgages, are now beginning to foreclose. And, in fact, prime buyers, home buyers, are beginning to foreclose, default, delinquent as well. In fact, that's the fastest-growing component of foreclosures, those who had prime the best terms. That's because of the 20, 25 million unemployed people just without jobs can't afford to pay. So the mortgage situation is still, as you say, new rounds coming, and the commercial property, that's business property, office buildings, resorts, hotels, and so forth, that's beginning to tank now as well. So don't look for a cessation of losses at the banks. More waves are coming. Now, what about the employment? How are they tinkering with that? Well, the number one means by which they're tinkering with it is adjusting the true number of unemployed by offsetting it with certain statistical assumptions about new business formation. You see, the number of unemployed, the number you get from the Department of Labor, is not a true absolute number. It's a statistic. In other words, they take the true numbers and they manipulate it with certain assumptions. And the biggest assumption is what's called new business formation. And they started really doing that to the tune of several hundred thousand every month. If you go back to April, May, all of a sudden, instead of running 600,000 a month, we were down to like 4, 3, and now 2. Well, if you look at the data, and what you find is starting April, May, they started assuming about 225,000 new jobs were being created by small business. Well, how could they do that? Well, they look at the long-run historical average of job creation because of new business formation. And they use that long-run historical average, not what's actually happening now with new business, which is contracting rapidly and losing jobs, but they use the long-run historical average, and they plug that in there, and, you know, voila, a 600,000 unemployment number comes out to be about 4 or 3 or 2. Now, of course, the Obama stimulus has had a little bit of effect, but it's a temporary effect, I believe, just like the Bush stimulus a year ago had a temporary effect. So that's having a, you know, a little impact on lowering the rates. Not very much, because it's not very much of a stimulus. And the other effect was spending. They did pump $150 billion into Social Security recipients. So, you know, the mild Obama effect and the Social Security boost here in April, May, combined with playing games with the new business formation, has had a little bit of effect. But we're still running well over 200,000. I would say, you know, the jobless rate is some new jobless data is about 400,000 a month, which is amazingly after you drop nearly 10 million, if you calculate it correctly. Real unemployment rate is somewhere between 17 and 20%.
So what you're saying is that if they say 200,000 jobs are lost in a month, we can pretty much double that number to get a more accurate figure. And it's astonishing, Jack. In my most of my working life, I was part of a small family business. And when we went through far lesser economic hard times than we're going through now, it really rocked us to the core. And we were lucky. We went right to the edge of the precipice a few times. And one time we had serious talks about just closing up the whole operation because we thought we were literally going over. Well, we managed to survive and end up standing on our feet. But my only point is small business gets rocked the hardest during hard times. How on earth can you get all these massive small business creations at a time they're probably being decimated and going out of business?
Absolutely. That's the case. If you look at these very sharp, deep downturns like the Depression in the 30s, who really got hurt? Well, it was workers, obviously. It was farmers, and it was small businesses. They took the brunt. The big businesses, the big banks, were able to weather it pretty well. They had the resources, but it was the small businesses, small banks, community banks, and, of course, workers and farmers who took the brunt of the downturn. And that's of course, what's happening now. But that's not to say that, oh, the banks are fine, you know. I mean, if you look at even the big banks, all this stress test stuff was a bunch of nonsense. Even the German finance minister said it was all false. The banks still aren't lending. You know, all this thing about throwing trillions at them was all supposed to get the number one strategy was to get the banks lending. That's why we're doing it.
Can I throw one more comment in? I read some other comments a few days ago that money and credit in the country is declining at a pace comparable to the early 1930s. And the comment by the economist who cited that said, this is absolute insanity to let this happen.
Yeah, and that's not the only thing that's on track with 1929-31. The job loss is tracking it almost exactly. The same kind of job loss in 1930 is what we're having now. And it wasn't until you had a second major financial banking crisis in 1931 that we tripped into a depression. So the 1929-30 period looks very much like it is today. And by the way, there was a hiatus of a, what looked like a bit of a recovery, and the stock market recovered before we had another banking crisis. So the question is, you know, will there in 2010-11 be another banking crisis? And that's a historic possibility. And that's when you'll really enter into the real crisis. Now, I'm not saying that's absolutely going to happen, but that's the title of my book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, ? Are we on track historically moving in a similar direction that we had in the 1930s? It's an interesting question to raise, and that's what I do with the book. But the banks themselves today are not really out of the picture. You know, you got really three banking sectors here. You got the big 19 banks. That's with the stress test. And I think half of them are still insolvent. If you look at the figures of recapitalization trying to fill up their black hole of losses, even the big banks are less than halfway there towards recapitalization. So it hasn't been all that successful so far. And the Obama projects, you know, the PIP, and the TALF, T-A-L-F, Term Auction Loan Facility, were the centerpiece of the bank bailout provisions a few months ago, have been total failures. They haven't worked at all. What has worked is the stress test spin, making people believe that, oh, these banks are fine. That was just a lot of nonsense to make people think the banks were fine. So they would go start buying bank stock again, and bank stock would rise and recapitalize these banks. Well, as I said, that's only partly happened. And then you have the second sector of banking, which are the small regional community banks, about 8,400 of those. And that's what the FDIC is bailing out at a tune to a half a dozen or more every month. And they even the FDIC and some of the reports estimate that probably between 400 and 500 of those banks will go under. I think it'll probably be closer to 800 of those banks before it's over. And then you have what's called the securitized or the credit money market, securitized markets. This is the hedge funds, private equity firms, money market funds, and so forth, that they rely on now, the shadow banking system, in other words. Well, it was at $1.8 trillion before the assets, before this whole collapse occurred. Now it's only at $100 billion, so it's dropped $1.7 trillion. There's no signs of the securitization market recovering, and we were so relying on that market. If that doesn't recover, how are you going to get a recovery of the economy, even from the banking perspective, let alone unemployment, and let alone, the question of housing? That's a big question mark, and it certainly doesn't look like a recovery when you look at it from that perspective.
We sure have lots of question marks, Jack, and we need to take another break. We can come back and pick this up.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jack Rasmus, talking about the economy. Jack, I get a daily report from economist David Rosenberg. He used to be with Merrill Lynch. Now he's back in his home country of Canada with a small Canadian firm. I was just glancing through during the break. He's got a long thing out today. It's usually very much shorter day by day. But one comment he made today was that he sees nothing organically positive in the economy today. Sounds like a bit of an understatement, would you say?
There has been a little bit of an uptick in some business spending, but even that is suspect simply because a lot of the rise in loans. Has to do with the junk bond market. Companies that are in trouble have been borrowing on the junk bond market. There's been a junk bond boom.
Let me add one thing that he said, Jack. He said the only thing producing the growth that we may be seeing now, or the stabilization or whatever, is from the government stimulus. And, absent that, we are really in the dumper.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I would add to that the nature of the stimulus is temporary. That's a very important point, and they're going to have to do a stimulus, too, next year. But, of course, the political forces don't want to spend any more on workers and small businesses and getting the real economy going because they've spent so much on bailing out the banks. The whole strategy is to fill up the banks' balance sheet, black holes in their balance sheet, and hope that the banks can recapitalize and therefore start lending again themselves and hold tight on everything else and wait for that to happen. And, of course, it's not happening yet. And in the process, you've got continuing massive unemployment and collapse of consumption going on. This thing is molecular. It takes time for the deterioration, the increasing consumption fragility, as I call it in my new book, and financial fragility combined to work their black magic and cause the economy to sort of erode even further during this hiatus or interim period, which will then eventually, I believe, result in another explosion down the road.
And very possibly, if it comes, and certainly there's a strong likelihood, Jack, it could be the second wave could be a lot worse than the first wave.
Oh, it always is. Not that it could be. If it comes, it will be worse, just like the 1931 banking crisis was much worse. It started with a financial crisis, the collapse of the stock market in 29-30, and then it appeared to stabilize. And everyone in those days thought, this was just another serious recession. This was not a depression. But then when that real banking crisis came in 31, it was quite obvious that this was something far more worse. And that's what tripped what I call an epic recession, 29-30, into a true depression. You see, depressions aren't single-line straight deteriorations. There's a lot of ups and downs. and cycles on the way down. There were like five recoveries of the stock market until it hit its depth in 1933-34, you know. So just because there appears to be a, quote, recovery, and, you know, and the whole question is, what is a recovery? Recovery should be you return to where you were. That's recover, you know, the definition. But what do you got now? We're just not falling as fast, and they're calling that a recovery? Well, that's just a you know, a spin of the whole situation. There's no recovery going on in any significant sense, but all the policymakers and politicians, they got to say that, and they are saying that, because if they said the truth, people would be even more pessimistic, and that would make it even worse. So, yes, they're all trying to give it the best spin they can, and, you know, that's essentially where we are right now. But the danger and the molecular development is going on within the real economy. We still have debt unwinding, both on the business and banking side and on the consumer side. They call that deleveraging, okay? But there's a long way to go for both the consumer and the banks to delever, which means that there's no recovery as long as deleveraging is going on.
Oh, very definitely. There's so much that concerns me, Jack. The debt situation, we really have a colossal debt problem, and we've had discussions on this program that a remedy to get us back to good health again really depends, at least one part of it is resolving this terrible debt problem that we have. So piling more debt on, just like we're in a deep hole called debt, and the solution is digging a deeper hole. Well, how the devil do you get out of this problem? If you dig a deeper hole, you can paper it over for a while. We can apply the stimulus or bail out the banks as we're doing right now. But eventually, all we will do is fuel a greater crisis at some point down the road. Nobody knows exactly when it may come, but the next one will end up bigger than this one. We've got the terrible unemployment problem, people that are really in dire straits. Consumers aren't spending. If people aren't buying things, then how can business get healthy again? I mean, that just doesn't compute. That seems anybody could figure that out. So we have that situation going on. And we're misdirecting other funds. We're directing so much toward militarism and bailing out the banks, instead of really effective measures to right the economy on the right track. So it seems like we're doing an awful lot of things the wrong way.
Well, we're not doing the things the right way that should be done.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jack Rasmus. Jack, let me let you pick up from my comments and yours to add on your expertise on it. But go ahead.
Well, let me just comment on this question of bank lending not recovering. It's actually getting worse. As the Senior Loan Officer Survey in July indicated, quote, demand for loans continued to weaken across all major categories. Well, you know, the whole strategy of the Obama administration was get credit going again, and it's deteriorating everywhere. Well, I guess the strategy has been a total failure. And in fact, the decline in bank lending is even greater than being reported, because what some of the banks, the big banks, are doing are taking onto their balance sheets the liabilities of other banks that are being absorbed, and their off-balance sheet assets that they were playing around with that caused some of the problem. Now they're bringing them back on their balance sheet, like J.P. Morgan and others. You know, they've absorbed WaMu, and they take all their assets onto their balance sheet, and it looks like they're lending because of that. So, you know, it's really not any lending. It's really a lot worse than it is. And also, it appears that there's more lending going on than there is, even though it's falling, because corporations, non-bank corporations in trouble, are drawing down their lines of credit. So it looks like they're lending. Well, that means they're really in a crisis situation. And that's why I said a lot of them are turning to junk bonds as the only solution, which means taking on more debt, which means next time, next cycle, they're even going to be in a worse situation in terms of debt ratios. So not only is it not increasing, but it's actually probably falling more than they're reporting. And you can't have a recovery in that kind of situation. And on top of that, then you have deleveraging, unwinding by your consumers, which is nowhere near a total solution. At the peak here, the consumer debt, household debt to disposable income was 133%. In other words, the debt was 133% of their 100% income. So far in 6 months, that's only come down to 127. I mean, it's barely moved. So this consumer is still overwhelmed with debt, as are many banks and many corporations. So it's not a recovery. And then you look at what's happening in terms of international coordination and cooperation. The G20 thing is going on right now. And all the signs are they're all bickering with each other even more. They're fighting over the IMF right now.
I was just about to ask you that, there is increasing friction that other countries, G20 especially, the big countries, are a little bit upset because this country manufactured the crisis and they're paying the price.
Yeah, what is this fight over the IMF about? You know, the IMF was the privileged institution of American global financial policies. Wolfowitz took it over, the neocon, right? And he got caught with his pants down. Big crisis a couple of years ago. And the U.S. lost partial control of the IMF. The Europeans took over. Well, now the U.S. is trying to reassert control by squeezing the Europeans out of that foothold that they got in the IMF. You see, the U.S. has virtual veto power still over what the IMF does. It has a 17% share, voting share, and it takes 85% to come up with a consensus. So the United States has veto power with that 17%, and the U.S. is trying to play China and India against Europe, squeeze the Europeans out and bring China and India in, and, of course, that's causing a lot of friction. And then, the IMF is the only thing that's keeping Eastern Europe from going under and sovereign debt crises and banks in Eastern Europe. Right now, that's the main way of bailing out Eastern Europe financial institutions. So it looks to me like there's increasing friction between capitalist economies and countries on an international scale. And, of course, that doesn't forebode very well. And a lot of other disagreements over what should be the nature of re-regulating the banking system. The United States really wants to go slow. It's very clear that the banks and financial institutions, shadow banks in this country, are just trying to somehow get through the crisis and prevent a regulation and so that they can continue doing some of the stuff that they were doing before and reap super profits through all this speculative opportunities. They want it to continue, and they're just hoping they can get through it. That's the whole strategy, keep the banks afloat, hope this thing will disappear, and we can be right back where we were. It's not happening.
That really seems, you remember the old song about the impossible dream. Well, in the song, the impossible dream comes true, but this really seems like an impossible dream that really is impossible. You inflate another bubble. Every time you inflate a bubble, it ends badly. And the bigger the bubble, the worse the ending. So here we are again. The banks have all this money. They've used none of it to open up the lending spigot. They're using it to buy up assets cheap. They're using it to speculate like crazy. So we're in the process, Jack, as I see it again, is inflating another bubble. And other people have referred to this as the bailout bubble. And it could be that this one will, if there is that second wave, it is a real a tsunami, much worse than this one. It could be that this bubble now being inflated is going to set it off because it too will implode at some point.
Well, look, we've been doing this for 20 years. We had a bubble in the savings and loan, in the junk bond market, in the M&A, in other words, corporate rating, private equity, whatever you want to call it, in the 1980s. We bailed that out at the consumer and taxpayer expense, and then what do we get? We get long-term capital management. A hedge fund goes under, and the Asian crisis, which was really precipitated by loans from American banks to speculators, and we bail that out, and then we get the dot-com bust, and we bail that out, and as you say, each time we do the bailouts, the volume of global liquidity and instability and speculative excess grows even more. But it's not just the Federal Reserve doing causing these bubbles. The real bubble is caused by speculative investing, which is partly stimulated by Federal Reserve bailouts. It's really the banking system increasingly independent in terms of money creation and credit creation from any institutions, be they Federal Reserve or whatever. They've virtually lost control of the credit supply. You know, we talk about the money supply being key. It's not the money supply. It's the credit supply that's the key right now. And the banking system, through the shadow banks, can create credit at will, and they do. And they take that credit creation and they use it to speculate and all these other opportunities rather than investing in real goods and services that create jobs. That's the fundamental crisis that's been building for over two decades now. And as you say, it will continue in the next cycle should they partly recover from this thing. All the signs are we'll be right back where they were. They want to do exactly the same thing. And by the way, you forgot to mention they want to make sure they continue to get these huge obscene bonuses. These banks have given back some of the money. They want to continue giving themselves super, super bonuses.
Well, they're having no trouble doing that.
No, they haven't reformed at all. And even the tepid reform proposals of Secretary Treasurer Geithner are being, strenuously resisted by the banking sector. And, they won't agree to anything. They want to just return to the way things were. And they think that if they just tough it out, let the rest of us suffer, they'll protect themselves and they'll be able to return back to the good old days when what they were doing. So I don't see any sign whatsoever that they're reforming the financial system, and that things will change.
Just the financialization of the economy, Jack, has really put us on a downward track. The healthiest time of this country in this country was when industrial capitalism, as opposed to financialization, was the backbone, the strength of this country. And if you go back half a century, and the auto companies, when we talked about what was good for General Motors was good for the country, what that means for me was that General Motors was a healthy corporation back then. Whether what was good for them was good for us is another issue entirely, but it was a healthy company. Ford was a healthy company. And other industrial giants, as big as they were back then, they were healthy. And to me, GM going under was a symbol of this country just literally going into the dumper. The casino on Wall Street replacing the real production of goods. And so we see China rising and we're sinking.
Well, I think financialization is a confusing term. I know it's used a lot, but it's kind of like globalization. You know, what does that really mean? It's such a amorphous term that it can be very confusing. I think the way to think about this is, what is the ratio, the relationship between speculative investing and non-speculative investing? Non-speculative is investing in goods and services, things that people use that produce jobs. Speculative investing is investing very short term in financial securities with the expectation of price appreciation and turning double digit super profits. And you got a big global glut of income and wealth and investable funds floating around the world in offshore tax havens and elsewhere, and they're looking for these speculative bubbles, and they're creating these speculative bubbles. Why? Because it's super profitable to do so. And increasingly, investment has been shifting toward that kind of an investment that doesn't create jobs and creates financial instability. So I think it's understanding the relative shift And speculative to non-speculative investing is the key to understand this. If you want to call it financialization, fine. And the key is the shadow banking system that's behind all this, and the regular banking system that's becoming more like shadow banking systems.
Oh, indeed. I think of financialization as the great growth of the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, real estate, combined with the way they run their operations. They make so much money speculating. I mean, they do other things, too. They have lots of operations. And, of course, they got so big, they've got insurance. And they do what banks do occasionally, but they make so much money speculating. So this is why I look at, and what's going on right now, Jack, on Wall Street. These investment banks are just giant casinos.
Yeah, well, the investment banks have kind of collapsed. There are, you know, except for Goldman and Morgan Stanley, that model is no longer. So it's not just investment banks. It's all these other institutions that are essentially unregulated with opaque kinds of investment going on people don't know. And the traditional banking system penetrating and foraying, all the hedge funds, well, who finances most of the hedge funds? Well, it's mostly the traditional commercial banking system that pumps that money into the hedge funds. Why did Bear Stearns collapse or Lehman collapse? Well, that's because the other banks refused to continue lending them money. Also because short sellers were driving their stock prices down to zero.
Well, I think
there's another form of speculation going on, you know. It's speculation run amok, and it's destroying the real economy, really.
And one of the big elements, too, the deregulatory environment that was spawned. So we got rid of Glass-Steagall in 1999, and then a year later we had this Commodity Futures Modernization Act that really just opened up this great derivative speculation business. So we stripped away the regulations, and we gave these guys the right to do anything they pleased.
Well, actually, you know, those acts and the repeal of those acts or passage of those acts were designed mainly to allow the traditional commercial banks to enter in even more deeply into the speculative side of the economy. The speculation securitization was beginning well before the repeal of those acts. In other words, the shadow banks were making these huge profits, and commercial banks said, hey, we want a big piece of this. Well, you know, you got this wall here, Glass-Steagall, let it down so we can go and get into that, too. And so you got to see the repeal of that as not the cause of the crisis, but a response to the growing crisis to allow the traditional commercial regulated banks to participate in the big gluttony, financial gluttony that was beginning and going on.
But of course, the shadow banking system should have been more regulated too, to let these guys. It grew so big, Jack, and of course, a lot of it has had big troubles during this crisis period. But that should have been regulated too, to curb these excesses that create these bubbles, and the final result is a great economic problem.
Oh yeah, well, you know, the shadow banking system was larger than the traditional banking system in 2007. Shadow banking is estimated was about 10.5 trillion, and the commercial banking system was about 10 trillion. So yes, it had grown even larger. But the whole history of capitalism is you put regulations on the financial sector when you have implosions and crises, you know, speculation is like water running downhill. It'll find a way around it, and over time, it will rebuild itself outside the regulation sphere. And that's what occurred on several occasions in U.S. economic history. And we're just seeing the latest of this whole process. And then, of course, as they get very powerful economically, they get a lot of money, and they control increasingly exercise their control over the political system. And that's when you get all the deregulation and everything. So it runs in waves, and it just shows you that you cannot really long-run regulate finance capital. It'll find a way to get back to speculative excesses.
Oh, it sure will. And the corporate control over the political system is another big element, Jack, and that's grown stronger and stronger during the years. So you've got especially Wall Street today. I don't think there's any sector of the economy with more control over the government than Wall Street.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, and a good example of that was some of the legislation that rose in the Senate here over the last 6 months, most notably trying to put some sort of reasonable lid on the credit card fees and credit card rates. The banks that issue cards make over half of their profits on fees and credit cards now, not loaning and interest rates. And the Senate tried to pass a law here back, I think it was April, May, to put some kind of reasonable lid on the amount that could be charged. I mean, typically, in terms of late fees and total fees and everything, it's like 40%. You can add it all up. And they wanted to put a 20-something percent lid, and they ended up with a 36% lid. Okay, it's from 40 to 36%. In other words, the banks can't charge fees and rates on cards more than 36%. Wow, what a big reform that is, huh?
I mean, it's really shocking.
Yeah.
So the banks can go to the Fed and get free money, interest-free money, and the credit card companies can charge 40% interest.
Yeah.
It's a lovely system we have, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
One more break. We'll come back, and I'll let you wrap up with some final thoughts.
This is RVN. The Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jack Rasmus. Jack, some final comments. And of course, this is a story that won't go away. And I shot you an email during a break to send some dates to get you back next month. And I've got a feeling if we get you back a year from today, we'll still be talking about this. But wrap it up with some final thoughts for today.
Yeah, well, all this talk about recovery is really largely spin, although there are some vestiges because of temporary injections of stimulus on the fiscal side. But, you know, you got to look at the fundamentals. Let's look at the banking side. Global lending is less than 50% of what it was at the peak. The securitization sector, money capital markets is down over 90%, no signs of recovery. Consumers, the debt to ratio is still 120%, 127%, only down 6% from 6 months ago, so the leveraging is going on. At the same time, you got 25 million jobless, which is not being reflected at all in the figures, like you say, covering it up. And you got the housing and new areas of mortgages and construction mortgages and everything that are still deteriorating. Now, looking at the fundamentals, those fundamentals, how can you say there is any recovery going away? We're moving sideways, while underneath the whole thing molecularly is rotting even further. And this is very typical historically, and it's going to take about another year, I predict, of this problems of debt and defaults and so forth growing in the real economy, and that will eventually feed back once again and cause another dip. It's like a W-shaped kind of recovery. And it's in that sense, it's very much like what happened in 1907 to 1913, a W-shape, or what I call in my book a type 1 recession that leads to extended stagnation. And should the extended stagnation result in another financial banking crisis, then you got something like 1929 to 31, or what I call a type 2 epic recession. And these things are I describe in detail in my book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. But I don't really see any fundamental recovery going on. It's a hiatus. It's not a recovery, and it's not really something that's going to result in a robust, sustained regeneration of the economy. Quite the contrary. Although it will look like, and they will hype it as if there's a recovery, but it's really a temporary stabilization of the banking system and a continued deterioration of the real economy.
It's a very sad situation, Jack. I remember when I was a naive college freshman or sophomore, I told my dad, who suffered through the Great Depression, well, you know, Dad, we really figured out all the mistakes that we made, and don't worry about it. We won't make them again, and everything will be fine. Well, everything was fine during the rest of his life. But here we are again, possibly heading into the same kind of situation. I really feel for the people who will be hurt the most by what's going on, especially if the worst happens.
Well, we'll see over the next 12 months. This is
we sure will.
An interesting period. And, we'll see whose forecast is correct.
We live in interesting times, that old Chinese proverb. Unfortunately, they're not the most pleasant, interesting times. But we are out of time, Jack. Again, my great thanks to you. I think there's an email in your in-basket. When you get around to it, I suggested a couple of days for next month. Get back to me, and I look forward to getting back for more great comments from you, Jack.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Jack.
Bye. Bye-bye.
And join us again next week. We'll have a full week of live programming, as always. Please join us then.